You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
I'm Drew Leiter.
And I'm Cleese Jacobs.
And welcome to episode 306 of the Earth Station DCU. Tonight we're going to talk Batman Beyond the White Knight number 5, Batman Fortress number 5, Justice League versus the Legion of Superhero number 6, Tim Drake Robin number 1, The Human Target number 7, Superman Space Age number 2, Action Comics 1047, Detective Comics 1064, The Sandman Season 1 Episode 8, Playing House, DC Legends Tomorrow, Season 7, Episode 7, A Woman's Place is in the War Effort. And Stargirl, Season 3, Episode 6, Frenemies, Chapter 6, The Betrayal. But before we get into that, let's talk some DC news. Alright, Cletus, the only thing I have for DC news tonight, Action Comics 1051 begins a setup of 3 stories per issue, while introducing new costumes for the Super Family members. New costumes will be worn by John Kent, Power Girl, Connor Kent, Natasha Irons, Kong Keenan, and the twins from War World. Now, did you happen to see the picture of the new costumes?
I did. It looked like a lot of, frankly, really, they were modern but reminiscent of the 90s Superboy look, I thought.
That's exactly what I thought, too. I was like, why are we doing a... Why is everybody changing their costumes to Superboy? I noticed nobody had a cape except for Superman. He was the only one, you know, he's in his classic costume.
As he should be. If you're not going to change one, that's the one that shouldn't change, frankly. So, I don't know that it's going to... Obviously, we're going to be paying attention because we're going to be reading this book, but I feel like that's the sort of costume change that not a lot of people notice, and it just sort of eventually goes back to something else.
Yeah, I know. But if you got to admit, the costumes are pretty cohesive looking. They're not exactly the same, but they're pretty similar in look.
Which kind of makes sense because they're trying to make this into like a unit, essentially, like a family unit. So, I don't know. I wasn't like falling over myself impressed by them, but they were fine. Like I said, they're reminiscent of the 90s, but they do look modern. Like they don't look out of place. So mostly just neutral to it, Drew, for me. Like they're fine. My opinion of the costume is it could only really be swayed by the story, if that makes sense. Like if the story's bad, I might nitpick the costumes a little bit more because I'm already in a mindset to be complaining, right? But if the story's really good, I'm like, oh, these costumes, great fit for the story. You know what I mean? So,
I'm interested to see how close-knit of a family we're going to be keeping with our stories and stuff. I'm kind of excited about it. All right, well, that wraps up DC News for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll do our comics talk.
Hey, hey, we're Monkeying Around, a podcast about the monkeys.
Almost 12 years old, Davy Jones was it for me.
I was having problems dancing and tambourining. I got overzealous and overly excited.
Like, we've had our own little version of Monkey Mania 50 years later, which is just crazy.
Be sure to like and subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. Check us out on Twitter, Facebook, and monkeyingaround.com.
Coming this summer to a podcast near you, be prepared for the return of...
The Jedi.
No, the return of...
The King.
No, the return of...
Swamp Thing?
You are such an idiot. The return of...
Oh, the Monster Sci-Fi Show.
Yes, it's coming back and it's about time.
The Monster Sci-Fi Show is part of the Rebel Alliance, part of your complete breakfast, and part of the ESO Network. It's sci-fi from a certain point of view.
And we're back! But before we get into this week's comic books talk, we gotta let you know, there's gonna be spoilers.
We got spoilers.
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 We've got spoilers, spoilers for you. We've got spoilers, 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 spoilers. We've got spoilers, spoilers for you. For you.
All right, let's talk Batman Beyond the White Knight, number 5. Barbara contacts Bruce and tells him that Robin was able to access the GTO file on Warren McGinnis. He was an engineering specialist working for Powers. They had a falling out, and a few days after he resigned, McGinnis was found dead. Bruce sneaks into Powers' building and gains access to his network through a computer terminal. Bruce can't find any information on the project, but does discover that McGinnis was helping the FBI go after Powers for treason. Bruce also finds a video that he can't open. Jackie appears and keeps him from watching it. Bruce tells Jackie the truth about her father's death. Bruce apologizes for abandoning her. Guards show up. Bruce takes on the guards while Joker downloads the files to a flash drive. Jackie disappears into the chaos. Bruce escapes through the ventilation shaft. When Bruce comes out, he is face to face with Batman Beyond, Terry McGinnis. Derek Powers shows up. Bruce tells Powers he knows about the project, and he knows that Powers killed Warren McGinnis in order to protect it. Terry teams up with Bruce to stop Powers. There's an explosion. Bruce has a panic attack. Jack takes over his body. Bruce helps Jack navigate his body through the guards and then jumping over a chasm. They steal a Batmobile and get away. Dick Grayson responds to the explosion at the Wayne Powers building. Grayson curses when he spots Red Hood. Jack goes to see Harley, hoping she could fix their Freaky Friday situation. Plus, Jack wanted to see her again. Jack tells her how he feels and then tells her he loves her. Harley replies, "I love you too, Bruce," and then they kiss. To be continued. I wasn't surprised at all we got the Freaky Friday thing. I was kind of expecting it at some point.
Yeah. You know, and honestly, Drew, I thought they pulled it off pretty well, where you had Joker kind of like reveling in like what he's able to do in Batman's body, like make the, you know, that jump over the chasm or fight the cops or guards or whatever. So that was fun. It was fun, but I didn't feel like he overplayed it either. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think like the joke overstayed its welcome. I thought he balanced that well.
Yeah. And I'm sure next issue they'll be swapped back.
I almost wondered, Drew, if they swapped back in the moment where at the very end where Batman and Harley kiss, made me think that Jack surrendered control in that moment back to Bruce.
That could be. They didn't really indicate it, so it's kind of an assumption on your part.
It absolutely is. I'm not going to say that that's fact. That was my interpretation of the scene, especially when he's done this a bunch of times, but with the shadows where you've got the shadow of Harley Quinn and Batman in the background. You know what I mean? I feel like if it was meant to still be Jack in control, I feel like he would have had a Joker silhouette instead.
That makes sense. I'm glad you pointed that out. I remember seeing that now.
And again, Drew, you are very right. I am assuming that that's what happened in that scene, but we don't know for sure one way or the other. And I'm just the way that I've read the story, it felt to me like obviously Jack was saying what he wanted to say to her, but it also felt like he was trying to. I think he ultimately wants what's best for Harley now, right? And that's Bruce. And so I think he was also kind of doing it for Bruce too. Then again, that's my interpretation of that scene.
I thought this was a pretty good issue overall.
I agree. I enjoyed it as well. I will say the only thing we're not done. Obviously, we've got at least one more issue of this left. The only thing that was a little bit of a surprise to me is I was expecting something more out of Red Hood in the story. Not that he was involved, like we saw him like briefly pop up towards the end of the comic, but given that they did that little mini tie-in series to this, I've expected him to be more relevant to the story than he's been. You know what I mean? I've not really gotten the point of that yet. It was a good tie-in. I enjoyed it, but it felt like it was kind of there for fun. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't really feel like it's had any bearing on the story at all.
Yeah. And they kind of threw him in here. I'm wondering if he's going to play a bigger part next issue, along with Dick Grayson. Because, I don't know, there's a reason they threw that scene into this issue, because, honestly, you could just cut it out. It didn't really need to be in here. The other thing I wanted to bring up was, you know how they have the previews for the next one at the end?
Yeah.
Did you check out any of that?
Yes.
Because one of the things I want to point out, they had a cool pinup picture of Harley Quinn in a Batman hybrid costume, like a Harley Quinn Batman hybrid costume. I thought that was pretty cool looking. And then the other one was this character named Blight. And I'm wondering if Derek Powers is going to become this new villain named Blight.
He definitely is. I will admit, Drew, I must not remember the Batman Beyond show, as I know I watched a number of those episodes. I must not have watched all of them, or it's been long enough I don't remember as well as I ought to. But Derek Powers is from the show, Batman Beyond. And he is the character Blight. I looked it up afterwards. And I was like, oh, I'm just an idiot. I know this whole time we've been talking, like, was he a pre-existing character? He reminded me a lot of Christopher Walken's character from Batman Returns. I knew it wasn't that character, but he felt very similar. And yeah, he was a pre-existing character the whole time, Drew.
Okay, I don't remember him from Batman. It's been quite a while since I've seen any Batman Beyond cartoons. So, I don't remember much about it.
Now, I must just remember, I feel like I remember the end of Batman Beyond more than the rest of the show. I remember the movie, The Joker Returns. I remember that for sure. I remember it was like in the Justice League Unlimited, I think they did like a sort of wrap-up story to Batman Beyond with Amanda Waller. I remember that. I wonder if that's it. I just remember some of those highlight moments and not the whole show. Because I watched this show. I know I did. But I don't remember him. So clearly I didn't watch all of the show. And then, yeah. He's in the first episode, Drew. It's not even like he like pops up randomly in one episode. Like, he's in the very first one.
No, okay. You brought up Batman Returns. I'm going to change the subject real quick, because the Artcraft Theater down in Franklin is going to be showing Batman Returns next month. Now, Batman Returns isn't my favorite by any means, but I am kind of excited to go see it. So I'm going to go see it next month when it's showing there. I've seen it on the big screen before, so it's not new to me on the big screen. But I am kind of excited to see it again. So, all right. I know I went off the beaten path there, but I just wanted to throw that out. I was excited to see it again on the big screen. So,
I mean, I've never seen it on the big screen. So,
well, it came out the year I graduated from high school. So,
I think I was alive when it came out. What year did it come out again?
1992.
Yeah, see, I was one.
So. There you go, audience. Now you know our age gap.
Batman Returns is a movie I like, Drew, because it feels dissimilar to a lot of the other... Like, it doesn't even feel the same to Burton's other... Batman 89. It doesn't even feel the same to me. Obviously, you know, it's the same director and a lot of the same cast, but it just really feels like its own thing. It's a little bit more gothic, I feel like, than a lot of the other Batman films. It's just a really, it was always a movie, like, Danny DeVito as Penguin always fascinated me as a little kid because he was just so weird.
See, and I always had a problem with that movie because Batman kills in that movie. there's no reservations about it. So I always had issues with that. The Penguin stories, it's okay. That Penguin is weird.
It is.
And then the Catwoman thing's weird too. So, I mean, it's
dark. I feel like it's odd because it is, you know, it definitely has some still Silver Age roots in it. and some of the like silliness of like Penguin is evil and is definitely does some pretty dark things in the film, but he also is a little ridiculous. The film is, it occupies this really weird space of, it does, I think on the whole, if you look at the actions of the characters, it's arguably the darkest Batman film that's been put out in a lot of ways, but it's also a silly one to at the same time.
Yes. And what's funny is you could almost call it kind of like a Christmas movie because it takes place during the Christmas time.
I have always thought of it as a Christmas, not like, it's not a movie that I think to sit down and watch at Christmas, but like when I think of that movie, I associate it with Christmas.
And it, of course, it has the trope where Bruce has to reveal his identity because he rips off his mask. We've gotten onto a tangent. But anyways, all right, let's get back. Let's get focused back on comics. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Batman Fortress number 5, Barbados in the Caribbean Sea. Jackson Hyde is sitting around a campfire with a bunch of other guys. Jackson meets a guy named Wade and they go off together. The guys come along with their hate and want to give both Jackson and Wade a beating. Jackson uses his powers to create a tidal wave that takes out the haters. Wade freaks out and leaves. Batman recruits Jackson Hyde to help save the world and Aquaman. Batman goes to Star City to recruit Red Arrow. He needs her skills for breaking into the Fortress of Solitude. Amiko will help in exchange for payment. Batman accepts. The Western Pacific Ocean. Aboard the Virginia-class submarine USS Novato, Batman monitors as Jackson hauls the submarine to their destination. Luther wants an update. When Batman goes to speak with Luther, he's wearing a presidential version of his armored suit. The two argue a bit, but Batman finally agrees that Luther can accompany him into the Fortress of Solitude. The submarine arrives at the Fortress of Solitude, hidden deep in the Pacific Ocean. Now, I want to ask you a couple questions. The first question I want to ask you, when Batman goes to recruit Red Arrow, she's really seems to be kind of money hungry. I have not seen that version of her before. Is this something new?
That seemed to be the writer's interpretation of that character. It felt to me like she was potentially homeless, Drew. I don't know if that's just me. The way they were portraying it, I don't know. That was definitely not, I have not seen that representation of her before. I gotta say, Drew, for me, I thought the comic meandered a lot for a story that I think is in the back nine in terms of getting done, right? I think we're close to the end of this story.
I think you're right, and I have to agree with you. It did feel like it meandered. I mean, we started out on Jackson.
We spent an inordinate amount of time on Jackson Hyde. That was, it's cool that he's part of the story, and Amiko being part of the story. I like that. Being them, him recruiting them to the team, though, that's cool. You know, we don't see those characters at the time. We've seen Jackson a little bit more than her, but I'm all for that. But we spent like a third of the comic on Jackson hanging out with the guy at the beach. I was like, what are we doing? You don't have time for this. It's, the scene itself was fine, to be clear. It's well written. That scene was very much in character for Jackson. I didn't think the Amiko stuff was, but like, so there's nothing wrong with the scene, but it's a, I think, 6 to 7 issue story, and we spent a very large percentage of that overall time we have with this comic sitting with Jackson on the beach. I just don't know that the pages needed to be spent on that.
Yeah, I agree with you. It's kind of veered away from the main part of the story. It's like the writer wanted to tell a different story, or at least get his 2 cents in.
Well, Drew, I gotta say, it made me wonder if the writer has a good premise for a story, but maybe couldn't figure out a great way to write a full 6 issues, and it is instead spending, you know, it feels a little bit like filler. Like, I've got a really good 3-issue story, but that I can't sell that to DC, so here's a 6-issue story with a lot of thumb twirling.
Yeah, I could see that. Let's see, what else was I going to ask you? I forgot already. We got off on that. Oh, that was the other thing I wanted to mention, ask you about. It felt like, to me, last issue that Batman and Luthor kind of cut ties. But this, when we come back to this issue, they're working together in the submarine. I was like, wait a minute. I thought their relationship was done, and they cut ties last issue. But then we come here, and they're working together again. I just thought that was weird.
My opinion of this comic the last couple issues has been a little bit what I said last episode, which is that I'm very intrigued by the mystery of what's going on with Superman, but I do not think it's been particularly well written. If that makes they've gotten me hooked. I want to know what's going on. Like, I want to read the next issue because what's going on with Superman? What's behind this whole thing? Very interested. I really want to know. Am I enjoying page to page the comic, though? No, honestly, I don't think I've really liked any specific comic.
I think some of the character interactions have been good, too. So, you know, there's some of that's been good, too. But I have to agree with you. It hasn't been a well-told story.
It feels like somebody came up with a really good idea, but didn't know how to write the comic to go with that idea.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. I'm still really intrigued what's going on with Superman. And like you said, I think this is going to wrap soon in the next issue or so. All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Justice League versus the Legion of Superheroes number 6. Vandal Savage is a sheriff in the Old West setting. He's got Batman locked in chains and is happy to be able to experience a world without the Age of Heroes. Vandal Savage starts giving his villain speech when he realizes it's all just an illusion. Vandal Savage is trapped inside Gold Lantern's ring. While Vandal Savage was playing Cowboy God, the Great Darkness was dealt with and contained. Vandal Savage has been found guilty of the highest crimes against reality, time, and space. The elders of Oa sentence Vandal Savage to non-existence immediately. In addition, neighboring parts of the multiverse will be put on watch for any potential Vandal Savage situations. Vandal Savage reveals his own ring and attacks Gold Lantern. The two battle, and then Vandal Savage disappears. The elders of Oa have removed the ring and its power from this reality. The elders of Oa state it is time to birth a new Gold Lantern Corps. The elders of Oa want Kayla Lur to work alongside the Legion to protect the galaxy. Kayla Lur is now the leader of the Gold Lantern Corps. Vandal Savage ends up back in the Old West with Jonah Hex. The end. Now, after reading this issue, Cletus, I have to agree with you. Bendis wanted to write a Gold Lantern story, which just happened to include the Justice League and the Legion of Superheroes.
Drew, at no point in this entire story were the Legion of Superheroes and Justice League at odds with each other. At no point. It is unfathomable to me that they marketed this as Justice League versus Legion of Superheroes. Now, again, did I want them to fight? No, of course not. But if you're going to title your story that, I feel like you have to. Because why on earth would you call your story that? The thing that tips it off the most, Drew, is if you, in this issue, it had Justice League versus Legion of Superheroes, the Gold Lantern Saga. It's like, just call this the Gold Lantern Saga. That's clearly what you wanted to write. It's a much more accurate title to the story. Which is fine. That's fine. Drew, I am totally okay with it being about Gold Lantern. Just call it that. It's a the one that they came up with is a stupid name anyway. Nobody wants that. I don't understand Bendis, man.
I'm wondering if it was Bendis's idea for this title or if he was told to do a Justice League versus Legion of Superhero.
See, now that's possible. The only thing, if it was a different writer, Drew, I might believe that, but it's Bendis, and I have a hard time believing that Bendis would be told what to do. DC lured him there. They wanted him. They're not. I can't imagine they'd then turn around and be like, "Hey, you have to do it the story this way."
Okay, I was just throwing it out there.
It would be a little like if Geoff Johns was forced to change the title of one of his stories, Drew. They're not going to do that. You know, he's Bendis. Yeah, like if it's Josh Williamson, I could believe it. If it was Rom V, I would totally believe it. He's not big enough yet to say no. Some of the other writers that we've enjoyed, I would believe. It's possible. I am dubious because I don't think that DC has the sway over Bendis to do that. I think if they told him that, he'd just be like, fine, I won't write it.
Okay. I'm kind of glad this is over.
I am too, because they never really, even the Gold Lantern thing, I don't feel like they fully, Bendis just keeps throwing out these ideas and then never fully fleshes them out because he's too busy just showing people standing around talking about what happened while the audience wasn't watching. Even this, Drew, this was the most current, like the last two or three years version of Bendis was the most stereotypical way he could have ended this story, which was the characters telling us what they did while we were watching something else. Like we saw Vandal Savage in this fake reality. Meanwhile, they fought the Great Darkness and shoved it away or whatever and resolved everything. And now we're going to stand and talk about it. I was like, are you kidding me? You couldn't even for 1 second actually put the conclusion on screen, so to speak.
I know. We didn't even see them battle the Great Darkness at all. We didn't see them stop it and contain it. They just told us about it. Yeah, that's typical Bendis we've seen in the last few years.
Just, yeah. I mean, just a big letdown story. And it's so frustrating, Drew, because he's got great ideas. You can see, even like with Leviathan or with some of the Legion stuff that he's done, there's interesting stuff to be told there, and he's just like it. I don't know what it is. It just feels almost like stubborn refusal to actually tell the damn story.
Yeah, I agree with you. And we've seen good stuff from him before. I mean, I love his Ultimate Spider-Man run.
He is who he is for he's a big name for a reason. You know, there's a reason that DC broke the bank to lure him over to DC. It's not like this guy's never done it before. He knows what he's doing. That's what makes this so frustrating, Drew, is that we both know that he's capable of writing great comics, and we've not really seen it for the most part, and it's baffling as to why. Like, I don't know what changed.
Yeah, I agree with you. All right, let's move on to our next title for this week. Tim Drake, Robin number 1. Gotham City Marina. It's been 6 weeks since Tim Drake has moved out to discover who he is away from the Bat family. Tim has been dating Bernard for 6 months now. Tim and Bernard get invited to a cookout to raise money for the marina by Mrs. Espagne and her daughter Cam. The city has been trying to evict everyone so they can turn the marina into an expensive place none of them can afford. Tim points out to Bernard who his neighbors are. When Tim gets back to his place, Darcy is there waiting for him. Tim shows Darcy around his boat, but the tour is interrupted by screams. Mrs. Espionne and Cam are dead. Robin calls Detective Williams in on the case because he doesn't trust the other cops working this area. They've ruled the deaths accidental. Robin and Sparrow can obviously tell this was murder. While turning over the crime scene, Robin finds a tuft of orangutan fur. It reminds him of the case he worked with Superboy and Impulse about the white elephant. Robin tracks down the disc and breaks it. Robin is able to take down the orangutan. Robin expects a third glowing animal in the near future. Back on Tim's boat, Darcy asks Tim if he's going to tell Bernard about his double life. Tim does not want to put Bernard in harm's way. Bernard is still having nightmares about the pain cult. Tim finds a package on his boat with a note. Clever work today. Until next time, Gumshoe. To be continued. First thing I want to say about this issue, Cletus, the artwork sucked. I hated the artwork. The way Tim Drake was drawn, I did not like it whatsoever.
Oh, Drew, when I opened up the very first page of this comic, that was my first thought was, Drew is going to hate this comic from the art perspective. I remembered that you really didn't like this artist when we read that Martian Manhunter comic. And we've seen them pop up a few times since then doing other stories. And I thought for Martian Manhunter, this art style was well suited because I thought it fit the alienness of him, of John Jones. That does not apply here. I do not think this is the right art style for a Robin story. It's so stylized and unique. It fits characters that I think are a little bit more out there, a little, like, you know what I mean? Like, Tim Drake, they're trying to tell, for the most, obviously, you know, they've got this murderer linking to old literary stories. I get that, but it's still trying to tell a, for the most part, more grounded story, trying to show Tim Drake in a, you know, in his personal life more. And you've got this goofy art style going with it that just does not fit stylistically with what the story is trying to do.
Yeah, I did not like that artwork at all. So you're right about that. The story itself was okay, but I don't know. It could be the artwork bringing down the story too.
No, I think the art really brought it down, Drew, because it was just, especially because there was so much of the story was trying to just show Tim as a civilian and spending time with Bernard as a civilian and all of this normal life stuff. And you've got this art style that, A, made it hard to tell who was who. Obviously, Tim looks like whatever the artist draws him like, but he never really looked like Tim Drake to me. He looked like a character with dark hair that we're told is Tim Drake. It made it hard to see what was going on in the story sometimes. It got better once we got to the superhero action, because I think this art style is a little more suited, again, to the more colorful fantasy parts of comics. So when it was Robin fighting a projection or whatever this thing is with the orangutan, it was easier to follow because the art style was a little bit more suited to that. But so much of the comic wasn't that, and it just distracted so much from what the writing was trying to do. I had a hard time kind of following initially what was going on. It was just not a good pairing. Again, it's a very stylized art. I like it when it's applied to certain stories. This is not the story for this art, though.
I'm wondering why we're putting Tim living in a boat in the marina. He comes from a family with money. I was a little confused by that. I'm assuming he was living with Bruce in the mansion until Bruce moved out. And that might be possibly why he's here. I understand he wants to go out on his own, explore himself without the Bat family. I can understand that. I don't know why they put him in a boat in the marina. The other thing I'd be interested in, how old is Tim actually in this? Is he over 18? Is he still under 18? I don't know if they specifically have said what age he is. If he's an adult, I'm sure he's inherited his parents' money. So, I'm a little confused about what we're doing with Tim here.
Yeah, I don't know. The marina is an odd choice, but it didn't bother me that much. I don't know. That was kind of whatever. Because ultimately, the other option is to put him in a studio apartment like every other character we're reading lives in and whatever. You know what I mean?
That's true. We've seen that lots of times.
So would it make more sense if he lived in a studio apartment? Yeah, probably. But I mean, I don't know. I don't mind this, Drew, because you could theoretically do something potentially interesting with this. And the other thing you could do would just be essentially nothing. You know, nothing noticeable. It would be anything of note. So, I don't know. I agree with you. Maybe it doesn't make the most sense, but there's at least the potential for something different with it, as opposed to what would essentially just be like the color beige if he was in the apartment.
That's true. But I do like the fact they're introducing new characters and, you know, they actually took some time to let us get to know Tim's neighbors and stuff. And kind of give us some background of what's supposed to be going on here. But ultimately, the artwork is bringing the story down, that's for sure.
Yes, yeah, no question.
All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week, The Human Target, number 7. Fire asks Christopher what he knows. Christopher answers, I know it's after midnight. I know I've had too many. I know we both should have gone home a long time ago. And I know you're a murderer. Fire asks Christopher if he wants to dance. Christopher answers, why not? Masked men enter the club and try to rob the place. Fire and Christopher keep dancing. Fire uses her powers to make the robbers drop their weapons. Fire states she wants to go on a Ferris wheel. Christopher pretends to be Luther and gets the employees to open up the ride. Fire states that Lex is going to be so mad. Christopher answers, what's he going to do? Poison me? The Ferris wheel stops at the top. Christopher suspects Fire busted the engine using her heat powers. Fire asks Christopher if he wants to kiss her. Christopher states he doesn't want Fire to kiss him. He wants Fire to catch him. And Christopher falls backwards off the Ferris wheel. Christopher states that now they are even. You poisoned me, and now you have saved me. It all washes out. Christopher again accuses Fire of killing, and Fire slaps him. Christopher wakes up in the afternoon, and Ice is lying next to him. They shower together, and then later they get a phone call from Fire wanting them both to come over. Fire states that Christopher passed her test. Fire tells Ice that Christopher is a keeper. Fire reveals that she got the money from John. They were having fun. Fire used the money to get the water from Booster, but she didn't poison anyone. Fire reveals that Guy asked her to get the water. To be continued. Cletus, it was so great to have the Human Target back. Oh man, this issue was really good.
It was so good. I've missed this comic so much, Drew. I can't wait for the next one. I'm already preemptively sad for when this series wraps up. It's so good. The art is so... We just talked about how we thought the art dragged down the Tim Drake comic. The art in this is such a big reason why this comic works so well. It is so well suited to the story that is being told. It just... It captures that feel of the story where it feels a little bit like an old school detective story. Man, Drew, I love this comic. And then the reveal at the end that Guy might have been the one trying to poison Lex. And you've got... Fire does not seem to be aware that they murdered Guy a day ago. So, Drew, where's this story going to go? You got the feeling it's not going to end well, but I don't know. Maybe it will.
Yeah, I know. Because if Guy is behind stuff, the question is going to be, where's Guy? And you've got Christopher and Ice who've basically murdered him and then hid the fact. It's getting really interesting. My gut tells me this is not going to go well. I don't know. It's really interesting. I'm up in the air whether it's going to end good or not. That's for sure. I'm really intrigued with it. Artwork is awesome. I'm just happy it's back. It's probably my favorite run of King so far. So... love it.
It's so good. This is, and again, it's hard for me to say whether this is my favorite because he's put out so many of these, for me, in my opinion, really good miniseries. I love that they're letting him kind of do this, Drew, and just, I don't think he's been on an ongoing since Batman, so all we've gotten instead are just these concentrated, really interesting stories. Strange Adventures was so good. Mr. Miracle was amazing. Like, it's just true. They keep coming. We just keep getting these books that I feel like are going to be classic DC graphic novels.
I agree with you. I honestly think he's more suited to these miniseries than he is a regular series. Just because he's so good at telling a well-written, tight story.
Yeah.
All right, well, let's move on to our next issue for this week. Superman, Space Age number 2. Metropolis, 1972. A pimp is upset with one of his ladies because nobody leaves him. The pimp pulls a knife and Superman intervenes. The pimp states he has rights and Superman agrees. Superman tells the pimp he can exercise those rights in New Mexico. Clark meets Lois in a bar. Clark orders the ice-cold milk. Clark tells Lois he's working on a story about a break-in. Lois has an interview with Superman. Superman stops an asteroid from crashing into the Earth. Superman has an interview with Lois Lane. During the interview, Lois states the world is concerned about an alien who, if he chose to, could destroy them all before breakfast. Superman tells Lois more than once that he stopped an asteroid from destroying the Earth. Lois asks Superman what happens the day you decide to stop caring about us, or worse. And the question bothers Superman enough that he goes to the Fortress of Solitude to ask his father how to convince the people of Earth to trust him. Gotham City. Bruce Wayne gives up being CEO of Wayne Enterprises to become Batman full-time. Maxwell Lord takes over as CEO of Wayne Enterprises. Their arms sales have been doing well because of the Vietnam War. Maxwell Lord's vision is to get people out of the dirty old city and into new, modern subdivisions and gated communities. As the middle-class Gothamites flee to the suburbs, they take their money with them. The streets become fertile recruiting grounds for gangs. Buildings started going up in flames. Bruce Wayne builds the Hall of Justice for the heroes of the world to gather together. Without a common purpose, the Hall of Justice is more like a clubhouse. Flash is practicing defusing bombs. Clark Kent is taken off the Watergate break-in and it's given to Lois Lane. Clark now has some time to think, and he heads to Kansas to see Ma and Pa Kent to get some advice on Lois. Superman does a second interview with Lois. Superman tells Lois the story of how during the war, his father didn't give up hope of being rescued because his friend Toby told him a boat was coming to rescue them. Hope is the lie we make come true. Flash is defusing a bomb during the middle of a JL meeting. Apparently, his bomb closet was full. Green Lantern warns the team about an artificial life form known as Brainiac who strips whole worlds of their resources. Brainiac is heading to Earth. Superman meets with Lois for a third interview. Superman states he is doing interviews with the press because he doesn't want to be a mystery to the human race. Superman states he understands why he may not be trusted by some people. Superman tells Lois his weakness is kryptonite. Superman tells Lois to print it. In order to get enough kryptonite, the governments of the world would have to come together to do it. Back at the Daily Planet, the other reporters get angry with Lois. Because of the Watergate articles, the rest of the reporters are getting blackballed. One of the reporters even states that when you let a dame in the trenches, she gets the rest of the platoon killed. Clark sticks up for Lois. Clark tells the other reporters that it is really the cowards who get their platoons killed. Clark and Lois return to the bar again, but things are different now. Clark and Lois talk and then end up kissing. In Gotham City, Batman realizes he's never going to win just playing defense. Batman sends the truth to the Gotham Gazette that Maxwell Lord is behind the arsons, but Batman's plan backfires. At a benefit to the poor at Wayne Manor, Batman takes Bruce Wayne as hostage. Batman blows up Wayne Tower and then the mansion. Maxwell Lord resigns as CEO and Bruce Wayne is reinstated. Metropolis, 1974. Lois and Clark get married. In 1975, Lois, Clark, and the baby go to the Fortress of Solitude so Lois can meet Jor-El. At the Hall of Justice, Brainiac comes to make Superman an offer to join his team. Superman refuses. The Justice League battle against Brainiac using Flash's closet bombs to blow up the ship. Brainiac has a backup ship and kills Green Lantern Hal Jordan. Batman shows up and foils Brainiac's plan, and the fight ends in a stalemate, or so the Justice League think. Brainiac returns to his multiverse team of Brainiacs and lets them know that he gave the offer to Superman. He didn't destroy this Earth because he didn't think Superman would agree to help if he destroyed his home. The Justice League hold a funeral for Hal Jordan. Superman returns to the Fortress of Solitude to be with his family. End of Book 2. This was so good, Cletus, and I tried to do my best to recap it, but man, there was a lot of stuff packed into this. A lot of good quotes. Some of his takes on the different characters were interesting, especially Batman. It's not a typical Batman story. I know Russell was trying to, show basically his political view on that. And some of the stuff Batman did felt weird to me, but I understand the point he was trying to make.
One thing I really liked, Drew, was Russell having both Superman and Batman answer the trolley question or the trolley dilemma.
Yes, that was really interesting. And it was interesting their different views on that.
I thought the way he had those characters answer that question felt true to the essence of Superman and Batman, no matter how you are adapting them otherwise. Because I agree, you're getting a different, clearly a different version of Batman, right? But that answer felt true to Batman. That felt like how Batman would answer that question.
I agree with you on that, because I thought the same thing when I read that. I just thought his portrayal of Batman felt weird to me.
And that's fair, because he does do it. I mean, but the Batman's been different the whole time. We had him, he was just he's a straight-up businessman in the first issue of this.
That is
like, true. He's not the same. This Batman's trauma, so to speak, is not his parents, like it normally is. Batman's trauma seems to be the nuke getting set off and all of the, and essentially that Batman feels a lot more similar to Tony Stark, Drew. Like if Tony Stark became Batman instead of Iron Man, this is kind of what he would feel like to me, I think.
I'm glad you put it in that perspective, because that makes a lot of sense to how this Batman's being portrayed.
It makes a lot of sense. That's kind of what he is, right? Because he's he's an industryman. And suddenly his eyes are open to the cost of his war profiteering, and he's like, he realizes he can't be a part of that. And instead of building a flashy robotic suit, he builds a bat suit. Yeah, I don't know. It feels. Obviously, there are other. I'm not saying it's an exact one-to-one, but it feels a little bit like if Iron Man became Batman instead. And that's not. I mean, that's interesting. It's different, but like the whole comic is a little different, right? Superman's not quite the same. The Justice League's not quite the same. Barry, I loved the whole idea of him like essentially using his free time to work on actually disarming bombs. That felt like one of those perfect little Mark Russell like side jokes that he explores that he then worked into the plot. Like Brainiac gets taken down essentially by a gag, right? Like,
yes. I love that. I thought that was great.
And yet he still has time for poignancy. This is what I've always really liked about Russell's writing, is that he can do both sides of the coin, where he has essentially a running joke that pays off with Brainiac getting taken down with the bombs. But on the other hand, you have the death of Hal Jordan in this, and it didn't feel cheap. Like it made sense that a fight that they were clearly not prepared for, right? As a team, they weren't prepared for it. They never fully took Hal's threat that seriously, telling them about Brainiac. And so if they're going to fight him and you're unprepared, there should be some sort of stakes to that fight, right? And that's what then Hal's the one that kind of suffers for that. That I thought was just, again, I thought that demonstrated, the strengths of Russell as a writer. I also thought his idea with Brainiac as a whole, Drew, was fascinating. I don't know that we've seen this interpretation. Like, again, it feels true to Brainiac, right? Like, this is exactly what Brainiac would do, but we've got a multiversal troop of Brainiacs, essentially, and the reason for his destroying of planets this time is to gather resources in order to fight the Anti-Monitor. I thought it was such a good idea. It was one of those ones that, like, it makes complete sense. It totally fits that character, but it's not something that we've seen either. Really interesting. I can't wait for the next issue of this, because, I mean, the other nice thing about these 80 pages, and you mentioned it, Drew, is that he packs so much in. He doesn't waste time kind of dilly-dallying with pointless stories. Like, sometimes we spend a little bit longer on certain scenes, but there's a reason for it. And you feel immersed. With 80 pages, I really feel like you really sink into that world. And you have a really long time to kind of experience it. And I can't wait for the next one. Whether it's the last one or not, I don't know. I hope not, just because I've been enjoying it so much.
I have a feeling it is. But one of the things I wanted to say was I thought Brainiac in this was, I like the interpretation too. We've seen Brainiac shrink cities and put them in bottles, but we haven't seen him steal all resources off a planet where it basically destroys it. I found it very interesting that he was taking the resources because he had a specific purpose of battling against the Anti-Monitor. And Russell's been building towards his version of Crisis on Infinite Earths. I'm very interested to see it because after reading this issue in Brainiac, I have a feeling Brainiac's going to be key in battling against the Anti-Monitor and saving the multiverse. And I have a feeling him and Superman are going to be working together whether they like it or not. I'm very interested to see how his version of Crisis on Infinite Earths is going to be, because that's what it feels like these two issues have been building towards.
I agree, and part of me feels like he's told us how it's going to go, Drew. I think maybe we saw it in the first issue of this, that we're not watching the world that survives Crisis on Infinite Earths, that we're watching one of the worlds that does get destroyed. And I don't know, I think there's something interesting with that. Of, you can make the argument of, well, then why tell the story if it's all for nothing? And I think in part that's what this comic is Mark Russell answering that question of, well, what's the point if they're all going to die anyway? And I think in many ways it feels like this comic is sort of his answer to that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm excited about the next one too. Both the issues have been really good. If you haven't checked it out, check it out. I can only recap so much, There's a lot of good stuff in there, and I felt like when I was recapping that I was missing stuff, but there was a lot of stuff packed in there. All right, well, let's move on to our next title for this week, Action Comics 1047. Superman addresses the United Nations because the planet known as World World now orbits the Earth. Superman tells the people of Earth that he has a responsibility to the people of War World. Most of them have taken their homes and only want to find them again. They need help to do that. While on War World, Superman saw technologies he believes holds immense value for Earth's future. In cooperation with Star Labs, John Henry and Natasha Irons will construct a new Global Energy Research Institute in Metropolis, which is expected to become the next leader in clean energy advancements and research. Superman states that War World itself will not be here for long. Some of its people have no homes left to return to, and a small number of them have expressed interest in making Earth their home. As Superman is giving his speech, Lex Luthor travels to War World in his battle suit. Unbeknownst to Superman, Lex and he share a mutual friend that has been keeping Lex informed on Superman's activities on War World and other things of value. After hearing Superman's speech, Lex has rekindled interest in the technologies of War World. Superman and Lois spend some quality time together flying. They talk about the two kids that Clark has brought home from War World, Otho and Ossol. Superman tells them the House of El sigil is theirs as long as they want it. Lex goes to Stryker's Island to make a deal with Metallo. They share a common goal, to save their home from aliens who would take it from them. Lex has brought John Corbin a present in a box. I'm sure that's his kryptonite heart.
Well, I wonder if it's something different. I wonder if it's the heart that Lex found on War World.
Oh, yeah. He did find... I'm glad you mentioned that, because I totally forgot he did find a heart on there, didn't he?
Mm-hmm.
It was kind of big. Do you think that was Mongol's heart?
I don't think so. I think it was just one of the many aliens that lived on War World, or was, captured and forced to live on War World. I don't know. I don't think it's Mongol's heart. I could be wrong on that, but I don't think so.
I forgot they showed that big heart, but that's kind of weird because Metallo's mechanical.
Maybe that's for something different, but Lex definitely was harvesting stuff there.
I found this interesting, Drew. I thought it was a nice kind of peek into where this story appears to be going next. I did find it odd that the backup seemed to be set chronologically before the main story. That was an odd choice. Because it's sort of, this story sort of threw you in like it was an accepted thing that War World was floating around Earth. And I was like, well, I don't think we did know that, but okay. The Lex story intrigues me a lot. That really had me interested. The rest of the story was kind of fine. But that was sort of, this was sort of meant to be an in-between issue, right? Sort of cleaning up, putting the finishing touches on the last story while kind of introducing what, where we're headed next. And in that regard, I thought this comic did a good job, and I'm excited to see what's next.
I am too. One of the other things I wanted to add was the addition of the twins from Warworld. Looks like they're going to be living with Clark and Lois, so we're going to see them with, you know, John's grown up and gone, but all of a sudden we've got Lois and Clark being parents again, and I kind of like that. Honestly, we kind of missed out with it on John because he went from being young to grown up so quick. So it'll be interesting to see that dynamic with the twins, especially with them being basically adopted by them. We did see them in the Superman family picture we talked about in DC News. So it looks like they're going to be sticking around for a while.
I think this is a really smart move by DC, honestly, Drew, because I think a lot of people, not just us, enjoyed the parent aspect of Superman and Lois raising a kid. I mean, clearly, as we've seen, that translated onto the TV show. And obviously they moved away from it because either Bendis or the company as a whole felt the need to age John up. I think we both think that that was a mistake, but they did it and they're not going to undo that. And so this seems like a nice compromise where you can sort of return the status quo of them as parents, but not undo the stuff that they've done with John.
Yeah, exactly. All right, well, let's move on to our last issue for this week. Detective Comics 1064. Long ago, on the edge of a desert, Talia al Ghul tells young Damian Wayne the story of Farhad and his trip across the desert bound to the demon Asmer. When Farhad had reached the other side of the desert, he learned that time flowed differently beyond its borders. His love, Elysia, had grown old waiting for him and passed away. Farhad cursed the gods and refused to move ever again, vowing to stand until the end when the gods were all dust blowing past his granite body. Gotham City Hospital, present day. Bruce Wayne learns he is in surprisingly good health, considering that his body is taking a beating due to his thrill-seeking. The doctor suggests that he might be having panic attacks. Bruce laughs at that notion of panic attacks after he does his disappearing act on the doctor. Bruce throws on a mask and pays a visit to the man in the hospital who is in police custody. He learns about a tattoo of a jackal head with long ears. Batman follows the clues back to Talia al Ghul. Bruce fights Talia in the League of Shadows. Talia is just a distraction. Batman realizes whatever Talia doesn't want Batman to see is happening at Gotham Harbor. At Gotham Harbor, Prince Arzan Orgam is about to arrive as an emissary of his mother, Her Majesty Queen Darja Orgam of Sevastril. Both Mayor Nakano and Commissioner Montoya are in attendance. The League of Shadows is waiting to attack. To be continued.
Drew, I thought this issue highlighted Ron V's strength again as a writer. I feel like the dude just really gets the sort of fairy tale folklore writing. I mean, that felt like it was his strong suit when we had Justice League Dark. We got that again when we would get these sort of, you know, stories that were told in Swamp Thing. And that was a highlight in this comic once again, where we got this tale of the guy in the desert. It sucked me in, Drew. It was like I was fascinated as I was reading it. And, you know, and around that we have a really interesting Batman story. But I feel like Ron V has this way of just kind of pulling you in with these little folklore story that he comes up with.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. I got drawn in by that story at the beginning too, and it's interesting how he's tying this all together, because we have Talia, you know, telling Damian the story at the beginning, and it seems to be tying back into the story. Really, really interesting. I thought it was also interesting that we're sticking with Mayor Nakano as mayor and Commissioner Montoya as commissioner, at least for now. We're keeping with that status quo for the moment.
I'm very, the Mayor Nakano thing, I think, is a whatever, Drew. I feel like that's just they've now established a named person that readers are now familiar with to be the mayor. So I feel like oftentimes it was just sort of some dude, right? So that one, I kind of expect him to stick around, if I'm being honest. Montoya, I remain fascinated at what are they doing with her? Is she staying here? Is she going to New York? What are we doing?
Exactly. I've been wondering the same thing. So right now she's still in Gotham. But she's also in New York. That's the question. So I'm fascinated what they're going to do with her too. And like I said, if she does become the commissioner in New York, I still believe there's going to be a delay in the Gotham titles before she actually moves over. So this is my take on it. Now we had the backup story in this. This is the Coda part 3 of 3. UQ Hart is surprised to see Gordon is still alive. UQ Hart attacks Gordon, but the boy saves him. The boy makes a deal with Gordon. He'll stay out of trouble while Gordon assists him with uncovering his identity.
Weird story, man. Weird story.
It was a weird story, and I found it hard to follow. I mean, this one kind of made more sense than the other two, or at least I seem to follow it easier than the other two.
It's a story I think got held back by an art style that was more stylistic than realism, which is fine, but it made it hard sometimes to tell what was actually happening in some of the panels. Not always, but occasionally it was difficult to interpret through the three issues what was actually happening on the paper. I think a cleaner art style maybe doesn't fit the story thematically, but I think would helped have made it a little bit easier to follow sometimes.
I wonder if we're done with Gordon as the backup in this and we'll do something different, or I wonder if they're going to keep focusing on Gordon.
My guess, Drew, is that we will return to him at some point, but not immediately.
Yeah, I could see that. All right, well, that wraps up our comic books talk for this week. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk our DC television shows.
Hey, Dad, what's the Soul Forge podcast?
The Soul Forge podcast is all about life, the universe, and everything.
Is it good for kids?
Oh, no, it's not good for kids.
Is it geeky?
Oh, it can be geeky, but it can also be serious. We talk about life, sex, dating, and mental health, and so much more.
Where can you find the Soul Forge podcast?
You can find it everywhere. iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, Amazon Music, and the ESO Network.
It was the dawn of another podcast. The Epsilon 3 is a dream given form. It's a home away from home for three guys to watch a 90s sci-fi classic TV show. Three guys with microphones over 3,249 miles apart, all alone in the night. The year is 2021. The name of the station is Babylon 5. The name of the podcast is the Epsilon 3. Veer, bring me a drink.
And we're back. Let's talk The Sandman, Season 1, Episode 8, Playing House. Rose Walker meets Lord Morpheus, the King of Dreams. Dream tells Rose that she is a dream vortex. Once every few thousand years, a mortal is born with the dreaming ability so powerful they can travel through the dreams of others. Dream tells Rose if she can find him in the dreaming, then you can find your brother. Dream tells Rose to keep looking for Jed in the waking world. Matthew will watch over her there. When Rose goes to sleep tonight, she and Dream will go in search for Galt and her brother together. Jed is having a dream. He is a superhero named the Sandman. Galt is his woman in the chair. Jed is after the Pied Piper. The Pied Piper attacks Jed with mice. Jed wakes up to a mouse nibbling on him. Uncle Barnaby has locked him in the basement to teach him a lesson. Rose calls Unity and gives her an update on her investigation to find Jed. Unity is having tea with the Corinthian. The Corinthian learns that Rose is in Cape Kennedy, Florida. Lucien tells Dream that Unity Kincaid is the sole survivor of what they called the sleepy sickness. The day Dream returned is when she woke up. Rose Walker is her great-granddaughter. Lita Walker goes to see Ms. Rubio at the adoption agency. Lita suggests that Ms. Rubio check on check in on Jed to make sure he is okay. Uncle Barnaby is not happy about the visit, but doesn't want to lose $800 a month. Ms. Rubio visits Jed and his foster parents. Jed slips a note in Ms. Rubio's purse. When Ms. Rubio returns back to her office, the Corinthian is waiting for her. Uncle Barnaby found Jed's note, and Jed's gonna be sorry. Rose walks through her friend's dream with Morpheus searching for her brother. Rose finds one of her posters with "Please help me" written on it. Rose finds her brother's dream. Galt tells Jed that Morpheus is the most powerful foe that they ever have faced, the King of Nightmares. Jed goes to face the King of Nightmares. Galt is disguised as Rose's mother. Jed reunites with Rose. Rose asks Jed where he is at. Before she can discover his location, Jed wakes up. When Jed comes upstairs, he finds the place trashed. The Corinthian tells Jed that his sister Rose has sent him. When Rose gets to Uncle Barnaby and Aunt Clarice's place, both of them had been murdered, and Jed is gone.
Man, Drew, this season is just barreling towards a fascinating conclusion. I have loved these last two episodes a lot. The sort of story and kind of budding mystery kind of swirling around Rose has been fascinating. We see her walk into her roommate's dreams. That we get the nightmare that wants to be a dream. That was such an interesting story, Drew. It's really good stuff. I've enjoyed the show overall. Don't get me wrong. I've been enjoying it. But these last two, just, oh my gosh. I feel like the show's taken a step up.
It's been really good. I have to agree with you. I thought it was interesting that Galt wants, she doesn't want to be a nightmare. She wanted to bring comfort instead of fear. And I found that really interesting. Dream didn't want to have, he didn't want to hear anything about it. I'm like, dude,
why can't you? Well, that's one of the things I've really liked about the show, even from the start, Drew, is that Dream is definitely the protagonist, right? But he is very frequently not in the right. And you're seeing characters that you might initially suspect to be, you know, antagonistic, like this nightmare, for example. But she's doing nothing wrong. In fact, she's helping the boy out quite a bit, right? And as best as she can. The only thing she can do is at least give him this dream world to escape into. And Dream doesn't, like you said, Dream doesn't want to hear anything about it. He just senses her to, you know, like go wallow in darkness. Just brutal. He's been a really fascinating character to me, Drew, because he's infinitely powerful and yet quite flawed as a being, and that's fascinating to me.
Yes, but even his sisters that we've seen all seem to be kind of flawed. Maybe the one that has been the least flawed is Death. All interesting characters, though, really.
Yeah.
This series has been fascinating. It's so different from what we've reviewed before. It's really intriguing. And I'm fingers crossed that this gets a second season. I don't want to lose another good show that doesn't get a second season.
That would suck because it has been so good. It would be a shame.
I have to tell you, I had Why the Last Man pop up in my feed recently saying that we reviewed it a year ago. And all it did was bring disappointment that we didn't get another season of it. And I'm hoping this has been so good. And I know it feels like Netflix has been dragging their feet at renewing it. One of the things I've heard is they're holding off renewing it because, unlike other Netflix shows, people haven't been binge-watching this. They've been watching an episode, digesting it, before moving on to the next episode kind of thing. Watching it like we watch it, you know, week to week. That's what I've heard. And Netflix is waiting a while to see how it does, is what I've heard.
That's fascinating. Like, that makes sense for some of the early episodes, Drew. I feel like the second half of the season has felt more bingeable to me.
And I agree with you, because, like, the last two episodes we've been watching, they all kind of tie together. So, but I don't know. They're really, it's really good. And it's the other thing The other thing is, we've had a lot of standalone episodes in this that have tied together. Really great series so far. Alright, well, let's move on to our next episode for this week. DC Legends Tomorrow, Season 7, Episode 7, A Woman's Place is in the War Effort. The time machine lands in the woods again. A toilet has crashed into it. The Legends find Bishop and are not happy to see him. Military personnel are chasing down the Legends. Using Constantine's key, the Legends escape through an outhouse. The Legends learn from Bishop that there is an evil Gideon trying to destroy them. There is also a Bishop bot helping her. Sarah and Ava scout the area and discover an airplane manufacturing company. It is the year 1943 and the height of World War II. The McDougal Jemison Factory. Sarah and Ava are put to work in the factory. Gideon becomes a secretary, and Astra and Spooner are not allowed on the manufacturing floor due to racism, and instead are sent to janitorial. Spooner figures a way to smuggle out the parts they need, and then come to find out that there is a secret workshop for them to use. Astra figures out a faster way to get the parts made. Astra uses magic to change the work order. When Staples catches Astra in his office, Astra accidentally freezes him with magic. The women decide to take over the factory to get the parts made. When Astra integrates the workforce, half of them quit. The remaining workforce reorganize and get the job done. Bayrod and Nat make sandwiches for the women. Bishop has a navigational interface for the time machine so Gideon can control it. Eleanor Roosevelt comes to check out the plane and brings Time magazine with her. Eleanor makes this factory a showcase to the world with its integrated workforce. Evil Gideon finds the Legends and they are under gunfire. Bishop fires back at them, giving the Legends a chance to get to the time machine. Bishop gets captured and is shot in the head by Evil Gideon's men, which turn out to be Legend bots. I thought this episode had a lot more of the zany things we expect from the Legends compared to some of the other episodes we've had this season.
I guess. I suppose it's not competing against a lot. I don't know, man. I didn't really care for this episode that much, if I'm being honest. It wasn't bad, but I don't know. It's just, it doesn't... this show doesn't have to be fun. Always, like, constant jokes all the time. I don't want to make it sound like... make me laugh or I won't watch you. But I feel like this season has had a lot less fun with the timeline than what they normally do. I feel like a lot of times they'll point out things that, like, not great things about the eras that they're visiting. That feels pretty consistent with the show. But they'll also do a lot of silly things within that timeline. And I feel like we've gotten a lot more of this season where they just point out the bad things about that era, which are true. I'm not going to sound like I disagree with that, but then they don't really have any fun with it. I didn't feel like they had much fun with this episode. This felt a little more self-serious and to me, when they completed the plane, it felt a little bit like they were all like, and we just defeated racism. You know what I mean? Like, it felt a little bit like this show was like, see, guys, racism is cured. We built a plane together. I was like, what are we doing, guys? Come on. This is a little bit more nuanced than that.
When I talked about some of the zany stuff, I was talking about the toilet falling on the time machine, escaping through the outhouse.
All within the first 2 minutes of the show.
Yeah, that's true. But we also had Astra freeze that dude pointing, and maybe it is typical Legends, but I don't know. You didn't like the episode. I enjoyed the episode. I didn't let the, some of the, what do you want to call it, lecture stuff bother me any.
Drew, I don't mind. I do not mind at all them pointing out that racism was pretty widespread in the 1940s. They're right. That's true. What I would want, I don't know if this is fair because they can do whatever they want. It's their show. But what I hope for with the Legends is that, yes, they can point that stuff out, but that they also have fun with
that timeline. Like, for example, when they, a couple seasons ago, when they were, they went to the French Revolution, right? And they, in they, you know, you saw some people living in this luxury, right? The rich people living in luxury that would eventually lead to the French Revolution. And like, they pointed that out, but also they had a ridiculous dance party, right?
Right.
And that's sort of, and it felt like this one, it felt like the show was still doing inherently something silly, like Astra accidentally freezes the boss, so now the gang has to figure out how to build a plane in less than a day, right? That's a normal problem for the Legends to face, but it didn't feel like they were doing it tongue in cheek this time. It felt like they were, it felt more serious, like, you know what I mean, Drew? Like, it was an inherently silly situation. They ended up in the 1940s because a toilet crashed on their time machine, right? Astra accidentally freezes the boss, and then they all gang together to defeat racism. That was sort of my problem, is that they, like, everything feels like the setup for a punchline, but then they asked you to take it seriously.
Okay, yeah, I guess I could see that. So, but I do agree with the fact that this season hasn't felt like other seasons also. So, and I don't know if it's, we're missing some of the, I don't know if it's because of the change in characters we have on the show right now or what.
I don't think it's the cast. This core has been what it is for a few seasons now. I know, you know, there's a few changes here or there, but it's the, this is not an unfamiliar cast for us. I really do think the show has been hurt by the fact that the nature of them not being able to pop into their time machine at the end of every episode, Drew, has led to these episodes feeling a little more serialized and not episodic. And I don't know that that's been to the show's benefit. I think it benefits a little bit more from being episodic, from being like one zany adventure to the, you know, 1700s France, and then one to ancient Japan, or, you know what I mean? Like, I think the show has been a little bit better suited to that, because if you think about the last time that the show was heavily serialized and they were telling an episode to episode continuous story, was season one, which was the worst season of the show.
Yeah, that's true.
And granted, they've tried to make it keep that sort of same feel. Like, we've seen very self-contained plots in these episodes, but they still feel more connected because inherently they're not going anywhere. Now they've started to recently, right? The last couple episodes. But even that, true, they... So we were told they were stuck in Russia last episode in the woods of Vancouver. And then they jump on their time machine at the end of the episode, and they start this one in the woods of Vancouver. But this time we're told it's 1940s USA. Like, I do think the show's being hurt by, you know, being a CW show, too, because inevitably, I'm assuming, we're probably going to see them pop out in the woods of Vancouver again, and we're going to be told that it's somewhere like Brazil this time.
All right, well, let's move on to our last episode for this week. Stargirl, Season 3, Episode 6, Frenemies. Chapter 6, The Betrayal. Rick tests the hourglass without the limiter and still has his strength past 1 hour. Courtney meets Cameron early in the morning and coaches him on controlling his powers. Cameron makes an ice statue of his dad. Mike and Jakeem bring Cindy Berman flowers and candy, trying to convince her to join their All-Stars team. Cindy tells them no and then slams the door in their faces. Yolanda brings Sylvester the gambler's laptop. Sylvester asks Beth to download everything on the laptop and then tells Yolanda to put it back. Dragon King or someone else may be a part of this. Pat and Barbara bring some fruit to Cameron's grandparents. They sit down to have a chat about Cameron and Courtney. Courtney is very surprised to see them there. When they leave, Pat and Barbara tell Courtney they don't trust the grandparents. Cindy catches Yolanda putting the laptop back in her room. Cindy still denies killing the gambler. Cindy tries to explain, but Yolanda doesn't want to hear it. Instead, Yolanda attacks Cindy. Beth unlocks the gambler's files and discovers that Cindy and Yolanda are battling. Beth tries to call Courtney. Rick tries to drop a van on Cindy and joins Yolanda in the fight. Cindy's shirt rips and they discover that she is just like her father. Courtney shows up and breaks up the fight. Cindy explains she started changing when they got back from the Shadowlands. Cindy stole the gambler's laptop so she could go through the files, locate labs, and find a cure. She didn't kill anyone. Cindy reveals to Rick and Yolanda that Cameron has powers and that Courtney has been helping him learn how to use them. The JSA have a meeting and they are not happy that Courtney has betrayed their trust. Courtney tells them until this is sorted out that Sylvester should lead the team. Yolanda points out that Sylvester already has been. Sylvester has a talk with Courtney. Sylvester tells her about his sister Mary, who fell in love with Brainwave and thought she could change him. Sylvester tells Courtney he trusts her gut. If she says that Cameron is a good kid and just needs some guidance, then he is on board. Beth goes to Courtney's house and shows Pat and Courtney that they are all under surveillance. Now, I want to ask you a question, Cletus, because in the last scene, we see the camera pans back from the monitor and kind of focuses on a puzzle. The puzzle has a picture of a skull on it. Are we supposed to assume that's Director Bones from the DEO?
That's a jump. I don't know, man. If you're right, that's wild. I will give you full credit for that.
Because it was hard to see the puzzle, what was actually on the puzzle, I thought. But it looked like a skull to me. And I'm like, the only thing I could think of that would tie it to anything would be Director Bones, who had like a cameo at the end of last season. But what else could it be? If this is Director Bones, why would he kill the gambler? Why is he monitoring everybody?
Why is he putting a puzzle of himself together?
Yes. What is going on? Why does it sound like he's freaking dying?
I got to say, one thing for me, Drew, I don't know if it's just because I was watching this during the day and the light in my apartment made the screen harder to see, but I could not make out what he was doing with the puzzle. There was like three different scenes with it, and they kept lingering on the puzzle every time he'd like put another piece in. But I can't see anything. What is he doing? And I could make out a little bit more on the final shot, but I was still like, it's so dark. I can't see what he's doing.
Okay, so you weren't even sure it was a skull, but that's what it looked like to me.
It looked vaguely like a skull, but again, it was a little too dark and I couldn't totally make it out. And I frankly didn't care enough to pause it and look more closely, because I don't know that we're really supposed to know yet. You know what I mean? Like, it didn't feel worth looking into, because I don't know that the show's revealed all that it wants to yet for that anyway. So I'm just kind of in a waiting for to be spoon-fed more information. Drew, so I liked a lot of things in this episode, but I was so frustrated because this felt so CW. Like, I'm so damn sick of episodes hinging on people not telling each other information. And this was just like the most cliche CW thing they could have done. And it was driving me nuts. There was a lot of other stuff I really liked. I like the tension of Stargirl and Cameron's relationship and how the grandparents and her parents seem not totally thrilled with it, right? Like, that's really interesting. I love the subplot of the two boys trying to get Cindy to join their team, and they're also sort of smitten with her when they're like trying to like woo her as a duo. Like, that's hilarious. Like, there's a lot of really good stuff, Drew, but the core of the episode just drove me bonkers. I was like, this is so stupid. Just talk to each other for 2 seconds.
I knew you were going to complain about this. I knew it was coming. When I watched the episode, I was like, there's too much drama going on here. Cletus is going to rant. But I have to agree with you. There was a little too much drama going on. And of course, Yolanda is going to get caught by Cindy, and she's not going to want to listen. And then, of course, Rick is going to be the next one there. I knew with those two characters going there, it was going to turn into a fight. It is just inevitable. So CW. But you're right. They don't want to listen to each other. And if Cindy would have just told them what was going on in the first place, we probably wouldn't have all this drama either. But I agree with a lot of the points you made. Everybody not listening to each other gets a little old.
The thing is, like, Drew, drama can also apply to the relationship between Stargirl and Cameron, right? Like, there's drama there. The grandparents, especially the grandma, is clearly not happy about it. The grandpa seems to be willing to let bygones be bygones as long as his grandson is happy, right? There's drama there, right? That's interesting. Because, again, because of the sort of tension between those. But instead, we get this sort of nitpicking and infighting, and it's just like this. I feel like you could do this season without this.
Yeah, you could. I knew
the murder mystery is interesting enough as it is, Drew. I don't need the finger pointing between the team, because I feel like we've had the finger pointing every season with this team. And I know some of that, yes, they are teens, and so some of that might be inevitable, but like, it'd be really nice if one season the JSA just sort of worked together.
Yes. Now, Rick, I was waiting for it to happen this episode, but apparently they're going to string it out longer. There's a reason why there's a limiter on that hourglass, and I'm waiting for the side effect to happen to Rick with him having the strength for too long or something. I've been waiting for the other shoe to drop. I thought it was going to happen this episode, but it didn't. So I'm guessing.
Yeah, I'm not going to lie. I was nervous when he was lifting the weight above his head. I was like, this seems like an unnecessary risk. What if it goes out? That's a lot of weight, my guy, and you're alone.
Yep. So I'm pretty sure something's going to happen with that. So interesting. Interesting episode. Is Bones behind stuff? It seems kind of weird, but maybe we'll finally get into the other stuff that was hinted at last season with Jade and her brother. Maybe we're going to finally get to that. Maybe not. I don't know. All right. Well, that wraps up our episode for this week. Do you have a shout-out, Cletus?
Yeah. So we talked about it when we were reviewing Batman White Knight, but again, both Drew and I were blissfully unaware of this fact, even though we definitely should have known. Derek Powers, pre-existing character, as it turns out. He first appears in episode 1 of the show, titled Rebirth, obviously followed by Rebirth Part 2. And he does become the villain, Blight, in the TV show as well, which we saw a preview of what that's going to look like at the end of this comic issue. So, yeah, I feel stupid, Drew, frankly. I should have known this. I didn't. I will say, when I saw Blight at the end of the comic, I was like, oh, he looks familiar. I think I know who that is. And then that's what kind of spurred me to look Derek Powers up. And I was like, oh, I'm dumb.
We can't know everything about DC.
That's true. But again, Derek Powers appears in the very first episode of Batman Beyond episode 1. And story is not dissimilar to what we've gotten in the comic. That's the other thing, Drew. Like, the comic is doing a pretty good job adapting Batman Beyond. I just am just too dumb to recognize it.
All right. And for my shout out, after watching the Stargirl episode, Sylvester, that's one thing we didn't talk about in the episode, was Sylvester and Courtney's talk. That was interesting. I think they had mentioned it before, but that was interesting. Sylvester's story to Courtney about his sister. And for whatever reason, it got me thinking about Jeff John's sister. And I actually looked it up, because I was like, when Sylvester started talking about his sister, I was like, wait a minute, wasn't Jeff John's sister's name Mary? I looked it up, and I'm like, you dummy. This is me being dumb. I was like, his sister's name was Courtney. which is what Stargirl was based off of. And I don't know why it didn't. I think I knew that before, and it didn't dawn on me when I was like, when Sylvester started talking about his sister Mary, I was like, was that Jeff John's sister's real name? Sister's name? When I looked it up, I was like, no, it's Courtney, you dummy. That's why he based the character on her.
She's supposed to be Stargirl.
looking into that, I found out that Courtney's first appearance was in July 1990, appearing originally in July 1999 in the comic book Stars and Stripes. Courtney Whitmore was a tribute to John's sister Courtney, who died in the 1996 TWA Flight 800, and she was 18 years old. And John was very open about his intentions to honor his sister, and even wrote fans a letter that Courtney Whitmore would not only carry on his sister's name, but also her spirit. Here it is. Her first appearance was in Stars and Stripes number 0 in July 1999. So if you want to check out her first appearance, you can check out that issue. I'm also going to post an article I found about talking about John's sister. If you guys want to read that, I'll post it in our Facebook group. I knew he'd based the character off his sister, but I didn't know all the details, and I found the article pretty interesting. All right, if you'd like to comment on anything we've talked about this week, you can reach us at our feedback line, 317-564-9133. Leave us a message or email us at earthstationdcu@gmail.com. All right, Cletus, coming up next week, we got Gotham City Year One, Poison Ivy, Multiversity Teen Justice, Batman, Dark Crisis, The Deadly Green, Dark Crisis on Infinite Earths number 5, and the Black Adam movie, which I'm very excited about. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time.
In brightest day,
in blackest night, no evil shall escape my sight. Let those who worship evil's might beware my power, Green Lantern's light.
I'm off.
Where are you going?
I've got to go punch a clock with my other boss.
I can see where this is going to be a long commute.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network. Be part of the crew and help support our shows by donating to our ESO Patreon or by shopping for the TeePublic store, which can all be found at www.esonetwork.com. The ESO Network, your station for all things geek.